Welcome. You're listening to Great Startup Marketing Podcast, where we invite over the marketing managers from the most successful Estonian startups to ask what has been working in their marketing and what hasn't. I am Andreas Oint.
And me, Marelle Ellen, as a co-host. We've actually been doing the Great Podcast in Estonian. So far, we launched 16 episodes with companies like Veriff, Factory, Bolt Food, Estate Guru, and others. And now we're switching the language to also engage English-speaking marketing and startup community, not to mention that we can now bring in even more high-level guests.
So if you're new here, then welcome. And if you've been listening to us for a while, let us know how do you feel about the switch.
And today we are going to talk about growth marketing and conversion rate optimization with Mart Virkus, previous marketing team lead at Toggle and now growth marketer at Contentfly, which, by the way, is a Canadian startup. So hi, Mart. Happy to have you here.
Yeah, hello. Happy to be here. It's awesome.
And also, it's very funny that you're an Estonian person, but you said that it would be a little bit easier for you to do this episode in English.
Yeah, I think there's then you just don't have to translate some stuff because I started working on CRO maybe in August. So there's a lot of terms I haven't translated yet or I haven't figured out how to explain them in Estonian. So this probably helps.
Yeah, I think we've been struggling with it in every previous episode. But Toggle has been a big part of your marketing journey so far. So I can't not mention it because it's also a kind of textbook example how to do build your startup while bootstrapping. What are your biggest takeaways from that period?
I think with Toggle, the biggest one is sort of the importance of company culture. I think the coolest thing about that company was it was a great place to work at, and the company invested heavily into making sure that the global team that we had, was all over the globe, sort of feels, as one that they can build relationships. So we had a lot of company trips, different activities. I think that was the biggest takeaway. Marketing wise, I think it was the lesson to take risks, to think big and, make bold bets and try things that maybe other people weren't trying. That was a big thing. And the reason I actually started with culture is that culture is super important if you want to, have an environment where people are taking risks, right? So people have to have the freedom. They have to have the sort of a safety net to be able to sort of make bold bets. So that's why, I can't say culture is not separate from marketing activities or, stuff that happens in the business. It's something that sort of, facilitates all those things.
And now you're working in a Canadian startup, Contentfly, doing growth marketing. Can you explain a little bit what does it mean and what are the areas that you're focusing on right now?
So I joined as a growth marketer and that was back in March. I think initially the idea was to build out a content marketing strategy, but I think growth marketing is a pretty ambiguous and a broad term. So it basically means that you have to adapt to a lot of things and you have to do what's necessary. So I remember at some point I switched to LinkedIn ads, so I tried to build that up instead. These days, I would say since the end of summer, I've actually shifted my focus almost completely to conversion rate optimization.
So you're not exploring new... I've always thought that growth marketers are the guys that have time to explore new things while other marketing team are doing those proven methods.
Yeah, I think maybe I should just change my job title. I mean, it's one of those things that you start as one thing and before you know it, you're just doing something else.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit, in short, what is CRO for you and why does it matter?
CRO stands for conversion rate optimization. And it's basically a practice to turn more of your website visitors into conversions.
Do you have to have a huge traffic in order to have anything to optimize?
Define huge. So I think not huge.
Thousands. If I don't have at least 5,000 visitors every month, is CRO something for me as well?
Then I wouldn't look at necessarily traffic. I would look at how many conversions you're getting per month, right? If you're getting something 10 conversions per week, then CRO is probably not for you. So basically you start optimizing when you've exhausted all reasonable options for rapid, growth in acquisitions, right? When you get to a point where you have a predictable and a working acquisitions funnel, right? If you have, 10 signups a week, you know, even 20, then probably your focus shouldn't be on optimizing, you know, those conversions. You should probably focus on getting more of them. It's difficult to say sort of what's, you know, what the number is where you should start thinking about like testing and optimizing things. It's subjective, but I would say when you're happy, you know, with the level conversions you're getting and it's stable. So it's like the thing that, you know, when you start building paid ads machine, right? So like, let's say for the first couple of months, you're building it up, you're, you know, launching more campaigns, you're getting more and more signups. Eventually, you know, that's going to level out. You know, you're going to get to a point where it's hard to get a lot of new signups fast. And you have to sort of like start optimizing your ads. You have to start optimizing the performance. Also because, you know, startups can't burn money indefinitely. At some point, you have to start optimizing your customer acquisition costs, right? And that's also where a website CRO comes in. You can't just optimize ad performance. You have to start optimizing like what happens to people once they land on your website and, you know, what will they do now? So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you go to a new company as a conversion rate optimization guru, how your first 2 or 3 days at the company would look like?
Wow, that's a good question because I don't think I'm a CRO guru. But first thing you always do is sort of establish, you know, get the lay of the land, like what's going on. Assuming you need CRO, I would probably start by collecting ideas. Figure out, okay, you know, we have to increase conversions. Like, how do we do that? There's a few ways you can do that. I think the, and again, I'm not speaking as a guru, right? So what I would do is number one thing, you always look at data. You look at, you know, what's happening on your website. You're looking for flaws. Like, are people dropping off from certain pages? Are like, you know, mobile Safari browser users, like, do they have a higher bounce rate than everybody else? You know, you're looking for like problems or markers in data that tell you that, you know, that there might be problems here or there.
Are there anything else like those alert signs or like red flags that we should be looking for?
Definitely. I think anything like device specific and browser specific, these just hint at technical problems. So these you don't really need to fix with testing. Most likely the problem is technical. It just needs to get fixed. Other, I think, red flags is you always have to look at, you know, the funnel. Like, where do people come in? Like, which pages they visit before, you know, they do a sign up. So another red flag is if suddenly, you know, sign ups start dropping very rapidly from a certain, you know, page in the funnel. So that's where you have a leak. So, you know, that's where attention goes. Like, you know, this is a leaky sort of spot. You know, there's probably something going on here. I should probably start testing from this. Mm-hmm. What I did first and what I would do first and what anybody can do first that's super easy is to basically just do an idea dump. You know, go through the website, you know, focus on these high traffic sort of funnel pages and look at, just write down any idea you have, like a random idea of like, you know, hey, what could I do differently, right? Can I explain this differently? Like, can I change the order of stuff here? Although that's kind of a useless idea, but we'll get to, the good and bad ideas, I guess, later. But do an idea dump first. That exhausts itself pretty quickly. And that's when you sort of have to, you sort of turn to user interviews, usability testing, and all those things that are probably the best source for actually, you know, worthwhile idea. So I think the thing with data is, though, I find that data often tells you, like, if there's a problem, but not necessarily, like, what the problem is. Like, you know, okay, people are leaving, but I don't know why. If I want to know why, you know, I'll jump on a call with, you know, a potential buyer or a user and try to figure out, like, what's sort of turning them off.
Okay, that's an interesting topic. Like, how do you exactly do that? Like, how do you find those people? How do you convey them to devote that time for you? And then what do you ask them to do to understand what's the problem?
I think finding people is the hardest part. You know, sometimes you just reach out to your network. Let's say I'm looking for marketers, you know, I'll just like write people I know on LinkedIn. Other people at the company, you know, might have recommendations. That's actually, I think, the least favorite part of my job is finding those people because it's just a dull and you know, just a time-consuming task. Once you get them, I mean, there's two things you can do. You can talk to existing users, or you can talk to buyers. And these are two different things. Talking to existing users is a great way to basically come up with ideas to improve, let's say, your messaging and your value proposition, right? Because they can tell you, like, you know, what really drew them to your product. And it could be different what you think, right? And it tells you, like, you know, what's the most important thing to them about your service that they're not getting anywhere else. So that gives you ideas to basically play around with messaging. And for me, I think, you know, messaging, testing different messaging on your website, that's a really powerful way to actually, you know, increase your conversions by quite a lot. The other thing is buyers. So people who are not your customers, but they're in your target audience. with these people, I do something that's called usability testing. So usability testing is when you invite them to an interview. Then there's two parts. First, you obviously want to know the standard marketing stuff, right? You know, who they are, you know, what their challenges are, let's say with content production, what tools they use, you know, who's the stakeholder, you know, all those sort of research questions. But the second crucial part is you basically, a usability test is when you give them, you show them your website, ideally for the first time, like they've never seen it before, and you ask them to narrate their thought process as they navigate your website. And that's where you get ideas, like, you know, because you get a clear sense of like what people are thinking when they're interacting with your service for the first time.
So you're giving them some kind of task?
Yes.
Or just let them explore?
A little bit of both, because the thing with these interviews is you can't give anything away. So you can't say like, hey, what do you think about, you know, this picture here? Because that draws their attention to that picture. But that doesn't mean that they would have noticed, let's say, that picture if you hadn't pointed it out. The point is you want them to notice the things they would notice sort of naturally. So I would give them a task of like, let's say you're on the market for a content writing service, right? And you land on this page. You know, what do you do? Like, what do you think? And, you know, I would ask them to basically, you know, talk out loud as you're, you know, looking at the page, as you're reading this stuff, like what's going through your head? The only time I ask questions is, you know, for example, when the interview goes quiet, you know, they, you know, often people are like, you know, they're looking at the website, they're thinking, but, you know, they're not saying anything. So, you might ask something like, you have to ask sort of leading questions, which don't give anything away, but there's something like, you know, what are you thinking right now? So it's like an interesting, there's quite a bit of like psychology involved, right? Like, how do you get them to say the stuff, you know, you need without, you know, making them say the stuff you want to hear? And
how long the session like should be?
That depends on like how much time do they have?
Yeah.
Every time you're asking people for their time, you gotta be conscious of that. An hour for the whole thing would be ideal. You know, often it's like 45 minutes, something like this. You can get it done, you know.
Okay, and what's the minimum number of the people in the test?
That's a good one. I think for, because the stuff you get from interviews is qualitative information, right? And I don't think for that you need a lot. I found that, you know, if two people like draw your attention on the same thing, I wouldn't call it a pattern, right? Because we're talking about two people. But to me, that's like an indication that, you know, something's worth investigating here. Like something's like stopping them or stopping people in general here. How many? You know, as many as you can get or as many as you can fit in your day. But
yeah, and I also think it's a good way to like have... There are many opportunities where you can actually do user testing. For example, when we were out eating lunch and mm-hmm. I had a laptop on and I just went to Contentfly website and you immediately said, wait, show me what's your thought process. Okay, where are you going now? So
using every chance.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, go out to dinner with your mother and you go like, you know, okay, mom, yeah, enough chit chat. Let's dive into this.
What are the other tools or techniques that you use to understand the customer journey?
I mean, there's obviously heat maps. That's one thing that can tell you sometimes misleading information about, you know, how people might behave on your website. Obviously, Google Analytics, you know, the standard. I don't think there's anything springs to mind right now. But
do you also like for with heat maps? Do you also use Hotjar where you also can record users and you use and you watch those recordings as well?
I have a little bit. Thanks actually for the reminder because that's something I wanted to get back to, but I forgot. The problem is that, you know, it doesn't have like narration. This is something you get from usability tests. You basically see them moving around the screen. You know, you can see them trying to fill out stuff. It yields some information, but you know, so far I've tried to focus on interviews because that's the really rich, you know, source material for this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, even with cursor tracking, let's say in Hotjar, you can see like, you know, at which fields, for example, in the demo form or, you know, in the sign up form, like where do they get stuck? Like where do they go? Like, you know, they type in their name and, you know, what do they do next? Like, do they get stuck in like a specific point? So
can you give us some tips on how to read heat maps? Because at least for me personally, it has been quite difficult to understand which actions should I take based on those like splashes in different colors on my screen.
Mm-hmm. I would say I'm not that great at using heat maps. What I've used more is like the, I think they're called scroll maps, right? Can't remember what the word is. You basically see like, you know, how deep people scroll. I actually just remembered a story, like a very practical example of how, you know, heat maps didn't provide great information for testing. So there was one time I looked at the heat, like the scroll map for the homepage, right? And I found that we have a testimonial section, you know, more or less at the bottom of the page. And I found that I think something like 25% or something of people, you know, only made it that far. So I made a hypothesis that testimonials, you know, can be a big trust signal to basically get people to take action on your website. So what if I, you know, put them at the top of the page, you know, more people will see testimonials, you know, more people will think that we're legit, and we are legit, right? And, you know, more people would convert. So I did that, set up the test, launched it, you know, after 1 month, like nothing, just absolutely the same, like no difference whatsoever. And I think it's also like my fault of like not properly analyzing that data, just like taking it at face value. You know, it was also a great lesson in terms of that, that just reordering elements on a page is not a massively great idea for an experiment. I don't know why, you know, there was no difference in the performance, but I would guess based on the results that the people who want to sign up, who are actually interested, you know, the qualified leads, they would go through the process of like scrolling through the website. And the people who are, you know, going to drop off anyway, they're not going to bother.
When it comes to heat maps, then Hotjar is obviously like the most famous or most known tool here. Mm-hmm. Is it really the best tool or is it just the most well-known
one? I don't know. That's the only one I know, actually.
Okay. That's what I wanted to
anybody knows
be
anything better, just, you know, drop us a line, I guess.
Okay. And then when you've discovered that, okay, there is a problem somewhere, then what do you do?
I think first you have to sort of write up your hypothesis. By the way, the experiment I just mentioned about the heat map, I think another reason why it didn't work is that it didn't have a good hypothesis. Like my only hypothesis there was that, you know, hey, you know, not everybody scrolls to the bottom of the page. You know, what if I put it higher? You know, maybe that will work. That's not really, it's not based on anything. It's just a pretty random guess. So I would write down like, you know, let's say, you know, there's a, I think in my case, I just want more conversions usually, you know, because I don't really have like, you know, massive leaky bucket problem necessarily. I would write down that, you know, it's like, so I talk to people, they said that, you know, they don't understand this. So fixing this, you know, would increase conversions. Like, how would I go about doing it? Like, you know, what could I change it to that, you know, would address the problem they were having navigating that site? You know, write that stuff down and make sure that that sort of starting idea is solid.
But where have you seen the biggest impact when it comes to testing, like visuals or messages?
I would say with the core value proposition, like the main message. I think the biggest success I've had so far was I had a 50% increase like in signups from changing the main title of the homepage. Before, you know, before we get into that, obviously you got to remember that, or you got to know that a lot of tests will fail, right? So to get like a 50% increase, you need a bit of luck and, you know, quite a lot of research, right?
So that doesn't... It was 50? No, it's 15.
50. 5-0, yeah. Okay. Yeah. In real life, it evened out, and we can get into sort of like, you know, how long experiments have to be a little bit later. Like in real life, the impact ended up being more, you know, close to like at least 33%. But that's still like huge. That's a huge increase.
I wonder how different the value proposition was, because it's still about the same product, right?
But here's the thing, like it's not like value is like the same product can have a lot of value points, like what's important to your customer. You know, are you cheaper than everybody else? Are you better than anybody else? Are you easier to use than anybody else? You know, you have the most integrations, whatever. There's a lot of things.
Okay, so you don't recommend just changing the sentences in the or change the wording. You recommend to change the whole value proposition.
Sorry, yeah. Basically, the whole value proposition. And one thing I will say is there's no point in making small changes. The tests that are going to be successful or have a chance of being successful are the ones where you make a very noticeable sort of bold change. I would say forget about like testing, like changing colors here and there. And like, you know, what if the button is red instead of light red or pink? What if I change this one word at the bottom of the page where nobody will see it? You know, you got to make some bold bets. So what we did in that particular case is that hypothesis that this is going to work, it was based on actual research that was done with buyers out there in the market, right? These buyers were basically shown three alternatives, like the original and two alternative value propositions. And, you know, they were talked through about, you know, does this work for you? What do you think about this? Stuff like that. So that's, these interviews obviously didn't tell you like what's going to work in real life, but these interviews basically yielded two alternative messaging versions that I then basically, you know, worked into a test. And one of them basically worked a lot better. So if you want to play around with value propositions, what you first, you got to have a pretty a good idea of like all the different value propositions that you have. You have to have a pretty good, you know, value map of, you know, all the things that you do for your customers, you know, all these different things that they are. Basically pick a few of them that makes the most sense and then, you know, test it on a very limited audience. Or don't test it at all and just, you know, put it into an A/B test straight away. But I think that can have a big impact. Especially, I think it has can have the biggest impact for startups that haven't done a lot of work on their value mapping, that haven't done a lot of work on positioning. Like if that's something that, you know, that you're still holding off on, I would say you have some, you know, potentially some big gains to make.
Okay, if we now go to the process of doing experiments and tests and so on, then I think that every small marketing team has like 200 ideas on how to do things or how to improve things, but obviously you don't have time for everything. So my question is that how to decide like which project or which experiment should you take as the next one?
Mm-hmm. That is, well, first, if you get to that stage that you have that many ideas, that's a good thing. Like, first of all, not a big problem, actually. But yes, you have to start, obviously, prioritizing. And I've built like a big Excel spreadsheet for prioritizing all these ideas. And the way I do it is I score each idea on like, I think it's like a 9 or 10 point scale. So I score the different aspects of that idea to come up with an objective value that tells me that, you know, this number is higher, so that idea should be prioritized, so we need to move on that first. I can't take credit for it, so it's not something I completely made up on my own. I basically looked at different CRO like prioritization frameworks out there, and I basically like took elements of each and put something together that worked for my use case. I think that's the same with every tool. You know, you can't just, you know, copy paste like somebody else's method. You have to sort of like think what's sort of reasonable.
What are the criteria then?
So the most important one, because I also use it to like get ideas, source ideas from the rest of the team. So one of these criteria is like, does that experiment, is that designed to increase conversions? I will deprioritize tests actually always if they are not designed to have an impact on conversions, because that's the only thing that you should be measuring with testing. Right, because you can measure a lot of things, but there's no point in measuring like bounce rates or like, you know, let's try to make people stay on the site longer. That doesn't really affect your bottom line. The point of testing is to make more money, right? You know, it's blunt, but that's how it is. So, you know, your goal always has to be an impact on some kind of conversion. The other thing is, so there's a lot of other factors. There's, you know, ease, like how easy it is to implement. Like, you know, is it super easy or does it need a lot of help from other teams? Is the experiment designed to run on high traffic pages? You know, low traffic pages tend to be lower in the less important for the funnel. Low traffic means that it takes longer to test things, it takes longer to validate, you know, get enough data. Is the change big enough? And does the change happen on top of the page, right? That's a big criteria. Because things that happen above the fold, they have a bigger impact because more people will see these tests, right? Versus tests that, you know, happen somewhere like lower in the page. One more thing, I also give a point or confidence. So confidence is an interesting thing because you can't really have confidence in an A/B test necessarily, because the whole point of testing is that you don't know the outcome of something. So how can you be confident? And a lot of the like the better known CRO frameworks, they use like a confidence score of like out of 10, like, you know, 7.8 out of 10. But how can you be 7.8 confident that this will work? Like you have no idea if that's going to work. That's the whole point of testing. But I find that, you know, giving like a single binary yes or no in terms of confidence for a test can help like an otherwise complex test, you know, rank a little bit higher. Because sometimes you just have a gut feeling that I kind of have a good feeling. Like, you know, I talk to users, it makes sense, it's gonna work. But, you know, I word that very sparingly, but you know, that can sort of like offset, you know, that very objective data-driven like system I otherwise have. And I think, you know, you can't be completely data-driven. I think somebody once told me that it's better to be data-inspired. Which means that, you know, you look at data, but you always leave room for like a margin of error or some wild card that you know, you don't know about.
You mentioned several criteria that you take like into consideration. What would you consider to be like, let's say, the three most important ones? I mean, if we're talking about like somebody who's just starting out and they want to do like the same Excel table.
Mm-hmm. maybe not even about the Excel table, but you know, first and foremost, I can't stress enough like how important it is to focus on conversions. That's the only thing that should change ever. And the other thing is maybe the doing things that are, you know, above the fold, the first thing that people see. The point there is that, again, you have to, the ideas that are going to be more successful are going to be the ones that are noticeable, that people see, right? Like the small changes, you know, they don't have a massive chance. So that's two. Everything else is, it's important, but I think, you know, these, you know, big changes and focusing on conversions, that's like the A and O.
I think one of a little more known model is the ICE model.
Yeah, it is. And I looked at that one as well, but that's problematic because of that confidence score.
Okay, yeah. It's
actually worse because it also has an impact score, which is, you know, arguably even harder to estimate. Although I think with the ICE score, actually impact means that, you know, what would be the benefit if this worked? So like, it's like the importance of this test to the business if it were successful. So I guess it's fine, but yeah, but it still has the confidence thing that's sort of problematic.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that something is A and O in CRO. Like, what are the other things that are A and O?
First thing that comes to mind relates to how you run tests from in a technical sense. And the one mistake that's super easy to make, and I've made it in the beginning, is not running your tests long enough. So when I started, I did a test, you know, I ran it for like 2 weeks. I used a statistical significance calculator to see, you know, whether this result is valid. But things change like over time. And now I would say, like, if you run a test for 1 week, that's super unreliable. The results are absolutely not reliable at all. Like 2 weeks, you start seeing trends, but things change. And things can change a lot. So I made that mistake, and I think most people do. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
What's the good time frame
then? 1 month at least. So that's the best quote I've seen. And it makes sense because if you run an experiment for 1 month, you basically account for people's behavior at different times during the month, right? Because people, like, let's look at B2C. People behave differently at the beginning of the month compared to how they behave at the end of the month, right? It's that old joke about, you know, you get paid, you know, first day of the month, you know, you spend a lot of money, you know, at the end of the month, you're out of money, you know, you're not really buying that much. If you run a test for a full month, you basically factor in all of those differences that, you know, might occur in the course of a month.
You also mentioned it's important to get key metrics. Also, mm-hmm. What are the exact things that you're measuring, right?
Yeah, again, sign up. So it depends, conversion events. Depending on what I want to change, like either like an, you know, MQLs, submitted MQLs, or signups as the events that where I want to see a change. Maybe as a third thing, I might like measure bounce rate, like, you know, hey, you know, do more people leave, you know, because they see this, but that's not like, it's more like a curiosity thing, but it's not really something I take into account a lot.
Mm-hmm. So if you're like planning an experiment, then you decide what's your key metric, what is the time frame, mm-hmm. what else?
Probably a lot
the
of things.
Hypothesis. Let me think. Yeah.
Sorry. maybe how I'm setting it up, you know, what the variant is. Do I have one or more things, you know, variants I want to test? Maybe there's two versions of a copy I want to test, or an element I want to test, or maybe if I have two ideas, like slightly different ideas I want to change, let's say on the homepage, I might set up some, I think about the setup, like maybe I'll set up, instead of like, you know, waiting to do, you know, to do one test and then do another one, I might set up a multivariate test, which is where you basically, you know, test the combinations of different individual elements in combination with all of the others, which takes a little bit more time, but.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you also mentioned was the A/B testing calculators. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about those and how do you use it? Why do you use them?
Basically, to know whether the result I got from the test is either statistically significant or is it gonna have an impact in real life. The problem with, there's a lot of calculators, and you know they can calculate a lot of different things. So what I will say is, if you're starting out with CRO and you start out with testing, like, don't overthink all the calculators because things get very complicated very quickly. if you're using Google Optimize, which is something that I'm using, you don't really need anything necessarily external to figure out, you know, whether your results are accurate. Google, they use basically what's called a Bayesian method of you know, doing, I guess, doing statistics is the colloquial term for it. The results that it's displaying, so it basically gives you the probability of something to beat the original or the probability of a variant to be best. You can trust that score pretty much, given it has had enough time. Again, you know, coming back to the 1 month time frame, I would say it's a pretty good indication of whether something's going to work. The only thing you need to figure out is that, you know, if something's like 95%, after 1 month, 95% likely to be better than the original, you know, that's it's a pretty fairly safe to say that it's in reality, it's going to produce the same effect. It gets a little bit tricky, but let's say it's fairly okay. Or, you know, depending on your risk tolerance, you know, you can look at it lower. Like, you know, maybe 85 is good for you, depending on, you know, how much risk you want to take. When I started, I think I used like an external calculator. So I took the numbers from Google, I put them in, and yeah, I looked at, you know, also the probability to be better and that stuff. Because at the time, I guess I had a distrust for Google's, you know, free tools. I have a natural distrust for free tools, right? I always like suspect that something's not working because it's free. But
now you don't think this way.
No, actually, yeah, done a lot of digging since, and actually, I think Google's the way they model probabilities is actually quite good, and it also takes into account different like odd factors that may, for example, influence people's behavior. Like, you know, they negate a lot of these weird effects. So if you, for example, take the numbers from Google. And you put these numbers into like another calculator that also uses the Bayesian method, you can get radically different numbers.
But is it the Google Optimize the calculator that you need to enter the data like yourself, or does it take it from Google?
So yeah, Optimize is Google's own like proprietary A/B testing platform. So all of the data actually comes from Google Analytics. You basically link your preferred Google Analytics view to Optimize. So the data is linked, and it's basically displayed in real time. So you can in real time see, like, you know, how your variants are performing at any given point in time, like what their probabilities are. One of the advantages of the model that Google is using is that you actually don't need like minimum traffic. Like, you know, that probability like changes through time.
But now, when there may probably be many listeners, including me, who will now start using Google Optimize, any tips when you're starting out with Google Optimize, what to avoid?
Yes. Again, let's go to mistakes, right? It's actually a pretty simple tool to use. So let's say you want to start an experiment, click a button. You know, let's say you want to do an A/B test, you add a variant, and it basically has like a visual editor. So you go into your site and you can make like surface level like UI changes, you know, change copy on buttons, some stuff. Pretty easy to use, but in some cases there's like what I recommend when you start using it is QA, like test your experiments before you launch them and immediately after you launch them to make sure everything works. Sometimes Google Optimize, when you're editing interactive elements on the site, it can break them. So I had one test where I think I changed something on the pricing page, and the thing I modified was in an interactive element, which basically caused the whole like interactive pricing page to crash. Luckily, you know, we caught it, and I think it was one of the early tests. You know, we caught it pretty quickly, but you know, these things can happen. So it's pretty easy to use, but you know, there's some weird like quirks that you can probably catch with QA.
I'm coming back to like the basics part. You mentioned that the test period has to be long enough. Mm-hmm. Is there also some kind of audience size, like mm-hmm. a minimum audience size, or how to calculate it?
Mm-hmm. It's maybe not even so much audience, but conversions. Like, you know, how many conversions do you have? It's a little subjective. I think one quote I've seen is that you need to have at least 400 conversions in your original and test variant, both, for the test to be like, to have like any doubt, you know, shot at validity. But I think it actually depends on your risk tolerance. You know, if you get fewer conversions than that, let's say in a month, if you're willing to risk getting false positives, you know, false results, go ahead. As I said, like, you know, if it's like, you know, 10 signups per week, you know, probably too soon. If you're getting 50 signups a week, and you know, and there's nothing you can reasonably do to increase acquisition massively, you know, go for it. But it's, you just have to, you know, the smaller the samples, the fewer conversions, you just have a higher risk of getting wrong results. On the other hand, when the alternative is to do nothing, when the alternative is status quo, you know, is that better? So, you know, it gets into this sort of territory of, it becomes more art than science when you look at A-B testing, like in practice. Let's say 50 signups a week, and start trying. Why not?
You said many, many times you will fail. Can you give also some more examples that you had with Contentfly, that you tried to test something, it failed?
Yeah, one failure was that, you know, moving around the testimonials. That was just based on guesswork, and you know, it wasn't a strong hypothesis to begin with. Another thing I remember, I tried to use the sign-up screen itself to basically reiterate certain very specific value points. Basically, you know, add some, you know, features and benefits to the sign-up page itself that I think used to feature a more general copy about, you know, the general importance of content marketing. So I thought, you know, hey, if I mention these concrete things, you know, maybe it'll reinforce people's opinion of us so that, you know, that we can provide value. It did not. It consistently failed. Again, it was actually another experiment that wasn't based on any like evidence. It wasn't like, you know, oh, because, you know, the data said that this is wrong, or, you know, people said that, you know, oh, we would like to read more stuff on the sign up page. It was just like a hunch or opinion. Goes to show that, you know, you need to base your hypothesis on something.
What would you say? What is the percentage of tests that actually have a significant result, approximately?
Well, a significant result can also be a failure. So a failure can be significant, right? That, you know, now I'm certain that this is bad.
Okay.
So that's a tough question, because that again depends on like how much traffic you have, like how quickly you reach significance.
But I mean, in your job or in your experience.
So yeah, when we start doing with optimizing, then we know that, I don't know, 80% will fail anyway.
I think that's actually accurate. I think I would say in terms of failure, 80% will not improve your conversions in real life. I think that's, maybe it's even higher, to be honest.
And that's good to know. Now we won't be so demotivated when we see failures.
Absolutely. I think this is not one of those things that you can just like, you know, do for 1 month and then leave because it didn't work. You need to do your research. You need to do the legwork. Then you need to put some time into testing. Maybe the first one will fail, but maybe in your back pocket you have another idea, like let's approach the same problem differently.
But hasn't it been demotivating for you that you're running the tests all the time but not getting any results?
No, actually no, because it's, I think we went into this with the mindset that we knew that a lot of these will fail. So once you have that mindset, it actually, it's really not that bad. And it's a lot of fun, actually. It's a really fun thing to work on. And the other thing is that, even if you fail, you usually learn something. That's another big thing, right? There's always like a takeaway, that something you can do differently, right?
Yeah, I think it also, you need to have a good company and good management, because I think like with conservatives, CEO doesn't know much about conversion rate optimization, and you go there after 2 months saying that, yeah, we've done many tests, all of them have failed. And then he's like, what I'm paying for you for?
And this is why we get back to culture.
Yeah.
And this is why, talk as an example, why culture is important. You need to have a culture of trust where people have the freedom to experiment with risky things, right? And this is something that needs that, yeah.
Speaking about tools, what are you using first to run the experiments and secondly to kind of like keep track on what you have done and what you have learned?
For me, Google Optimize. I actually haven't, again, you know, I've been at it for that long, so I haven't tried any other tools. You know, there's some pretty expensive options on the market, but yeah, I'm for the time being, Google Optimize has worked out great for me. In terms of learnings, I mean, I use Notion for like pretty much anything. That's my go-to tool for documenting anything. I basically, for each experiment, I try to keep documentation. What was the hypothesis? Because you want to be able to come back, like when, let's say a new person joins the team, you want to be able to like say, oh, we tested this thing. This is how it worked, and this is why we tested it, right? You want that information to be there. And also, I also document the results, you know, how I analyze the results, why do I think it's significant? Like, why do I think that this will work in real life or won't? So yeah, Notion for me.
So it's like a Wikipedia for your company. Not a Wikipedia, wiki.
Inner wiki or something.
Inner wiki.
Kind of, yeah. I like it. I don't know if you guys use it, but it's good. A very like it's easy on the eyes.
Yeah. Plus Notion is probably like all of those different team management tools put together.
Yes. Yes. So instead of having like, you know, Drive folders with, you know, documents and spreadsheets, it's much easier to have everything in the same place.
Before we started recording, you also mentioned the CXL calculator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually, I think, I've used their calculator to basically, you know, calculate sample sizes and those things. CXL is, so it's an Estonian-run company. I think they originally used to do A/B testing services. Can't vouch for that, but they have a really good blog. They have really good sources on anything CRO related. So I've learned a lot of, you know, they have very straightforward blog posts about, you know, what you should do, what you shouldn't, and, you know, all the risks involved. So definitely recommend reading pretty much anything they write.
But for user testing, you're just using like Zoom or Google Meets, or do you have some software for that as well?
So yes, other than Zoom, there's a great app called Perfect Recall that basically, you know, records the video and also a transcript. So you can basically search the transcript, you know, for specific information. I have also used, for actually sourcing candidates, I used respondent.io. It's a platform where you basically put up your research call. You know, I want to do research calls on this. A bunch of people apply based on what, you know, if the platform thinks that they have relevant skills to your target audience. And then, you know, you go through this list of people and, you know, you select them for interviews. And, you know, there's an incentive system built in. So you can, like, let's say, pay each of them $50 for, you know, 45 minutes, for example. It actually makes it a lot easier to find people to interview. The only downside of that platform is the targeting is not perfect. And sometimes you get people on your interviews who necessarily don't have the experience that you thought they had by looking at their profile. But, you know, you roll with the punches, I guess. So,
but have you taken any, or do you recommend any courses on CRO?
Yeah, so the first thing I did when I started working on this was there's a great course on CRO on Udemy that I think pretty much that's the first thing that pops up when you search it there. It's a great source that covers basically the whole thing down to like differences in different statistical models and the risks associated with each. It's a little bit e-commerce oriented, the example that they use to go through the whole thing. But I think the lessons you can apply to like B2B as well, so not really a problem. That was the main thing for me. Then, you know, it's just like, you know, Googling the main things, like the main terms, like what's significance, stuff like that. And I think that's actually enough to start with. You can go pretty deep down the rabbit hole to the point that I was thinking about this, I think, yesterday, that I feel like I know less about A/B testing than I did, you know, 2 months ago, because I went down the rabbit hole of like trying to understand exactly like what the difference is between, I don't know, like the Bayesian method and the frequentist method of statistical significance, all those things. And it's good to read up on these things, but, you know, don't overthink it in the beginning.
Okay, I think we've had quite good insights on CRO. Not sure if we forgot to.
I mean, I would one thing about measuring results is that, and this is super important, CRO or A/B testing in practice is about finding a compromise between speed and like scientific accuracy. And I don't think it's a good idea to get stuck on accuracy. You know, you can't set the confidence levels of your, you know, results too high in order to, you know, be sure that you have the a correct result. In business, you kind of have to move fast, right? So if you're not moving fast, your competitors are. And sometimes you have to take risks and, you know, maybe declare a winner from your experiment and like just try a change, even though you're maybe not 100% sure that you know, the test result is accurate. So there's a lot of like that fine line stuff. Where's the moment where, you know, you think, okay, this result is good enough, but I really need to launch things now because we need to increase our conversions, like in real life.
Cool. Contentfly is a Canadian startup, and I bet that they do some things differently than Estonians do.
Or do they?
Actually, I don't think they do. Like, it's a hyper-growth startup. It's a very sort of fast-moving environment. You know, a lot of changes. They have to adapt very quickly. It's kind of cool to watch like how quickly they built up like a pretty sophisticated go-to-market organization with like a pretty sophisticated marketing technology stack. Like, I haven't worked at, for example, Wise or Bolt, but I would wager that there's nothing that, you know, they do differently from Bolt or, you know, any of the really successful Estonian startups.
Okay, but then I'm finishing up with our traditional last question.
Mm-hmm.
What is one recommendation when it comes to marketing books or blogs or podcasts besides
CXL?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I was mostly coming in here like thinking about that. Oh, God, yeah. I have to think about this because I'm assuming we can cut out the thinking pause later in post. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
very interesting because usually, yeah, our guests usually they have something that immediately pops to their mind.
Yeah,
so it seems like you have a different process of learning.
I have a very, because I'm pretty deep into the CRO stuff right now. So, like as I said, like CXL is the one thing that stands out. There's you know other things. I'm always googling about problems I'm having and stuff like that. The others I haven't really noticed anything that's has a brand awareness that I want to come back here and you know learn more about what these guys do. So,
well, nice. Thanks, Mart, for sharing all the knowledge with us and told how things should be done. And thank you for listening to the episode. I hope you found some practical takeaways you can apply tomorrow. If you're listening to us on Spotify, Google, or Apple Podcasts, make sure to subscribe to be the first one to know where startup marketing is heading to. See you at our next episode where we sit down with another experienced startup marketer. Take care, and as we always say, eduk turundamist.